seems to me that our culture has built a sort of covenant, an agreement, a friendly relationship with discontentment. It seems like somehow discontentment has been seen today as the motivation for just about everything worth doing in our world. So when we talk about what causes a human being to create a new piece of technology, we assume that discontentment is what's going to do that. What's the old saying from Plato's Republic? Necessity is the mother of invention. Discontentment. Discontentment can be okay, I suppose, if it motivates us to do good things or to improve ourselves. But there's a bad side of discontentment as well. Because discontentment is at the heart of almost every major character sin in Scripture. It's discontentment that's at the heart of envy. It's at the heart of coveting. It's at the heart of lust. We are discontent with what our lives presently are all about. And then there's an ugly side to discontentment. Discontentment leads to violent acts, oftentimes against other people. Whether we're talking about theft or adultery, wars of expansion for land or resources, acts of vindictiveness against others, all can be fruits of discontentment. So we're in this interesting place in our world today, and I think it's going to dovetail almost perfectly with the world of the judges, in which we've made a compact, a covenant, an agreement with discontentment. We've allowed it to be our motivation for just about everything we do. And yet it is at its root the foundation of most of the sins in the Christian church we try to war against. But that brings us to Judges chapter 3. Judges chapter 3, beginning in verse 12, and I'm reading from the New Revised Standard Version. The Israelites again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord strengthened King Eglon of Moab against Israel, because they had done what was evil in the sight of the Lord. In alliance with the Ammonites and the Amalekites, he went and defeated Israel, and they took possession of the city of palms. So the Israelites served King Eglon of Moab 18 years. But when the Israelites cried out to the Lord, the Lord raised up for them a deliverer, Ehud, son of Gera, the Benjaminite, a left-handed man. The Israelites sent tribute by him to King Eglon of Moab. Ehud made for himself a sword with two edges, a cubit in length, and he fastened it on his right thigh under his clothes. Then he presented the tribute to King Eglon of Moab. Now Eglon was a very fat man. When Ehud had finished presenting the tribute, he sent the people who carried the tribute on their way. But he himself turned back at the sculptured stones near Gilgal and said, "I have a secret message for you, O king." So the king said, "Silence." And all his attendants went out from his presence. Ehud came to him while he was sitting alone in his cool roof chamber and said, "I have a message from God for you." So he rose from his seat. Then Ehud reached with his left hand, took the sword from his right thigh, and thrust it into Eglon's belly. The hilt also went in after the blade, and the fat closed over the blade, for he did not draw the sword out of his belly. I don't know what your translation says here. Mine says, "and the dirt came out." The way I read the Hebrew is the sword punctured his back. Then Ehud went out into the vestibule and closed the doors of the roof chamber on him and locked them. After he had gone, the servants came. When they saw that the doors of the roof chamber were locked, they thought he must be relieving himself in the cool chamber. So they waited until they were embarrassed. When he still did not open the doors of the roof chamber, they took the key and opened them. There was their Lord lying dead on the floor. Ehud escaped while they delayed and passed beyond the sculptured stones and escaped to Sirah. When he arrived, he sounded the trumpet in the hill country of Ephraim, and the Israelites went down with him from the hill country, having him at their head. He said to them, "Follow after me, for the Lord has given your enemies, the Moabites, into your hand." So they went down after him and seized the fords of the Jordan against the Moabites and allowed no one to cross over. At that time, they killed about 10,000 of the Moabites, all strong, able-bodied men. No one escaped. So Moab was subdued that day under the hand of Israel, and the land had rest 80 years. I think discontentment is at the heart of why Moab attacked Israel, so we're going to be talking about that. But I want to have another passage in front of us, and this is a guiding passage for us. It's not from the book of Judges, it's from the book of 1 Timothy, chapter 6. I'm just going to read verses 6 through 10. We're going to return to this in the last point of the sermon, but we need to have it here at the beginning so we understand what we're talking about. 1 Timothy chapter 6, beginning in verse 6, says this: "Of course, there is great gain in godliness combined with contentment. For we brought nothing into the world so that we can take nothing out of it. But if we have food and clothing, we'll be content with these. But those who want to be rich fall into temptation and are trapped by many senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. And in their eagerness to be rich, some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pains." So let's keep that in front of us as we journey through the story of Moab and Ehud and some of what happens there. And as we journey through this episode in Judges chapter 3, remembering that godliness with contentment, according to the New Testament, is great gain, we're going to pass through three concentric circles. We're first going to talk about Moab. Who were they? Why did they do this? What's at stake in the story? Why bother to tell it to us? We're going to start with that. Moab is kind of a big circle. And then inside of that, we're going to talk about an issue that comes up over and over again in the First Testament, the idea of boundary stones, and that we should never move them. And then we'll finally get to the core of the matter, the discontented heart of each human. So let's start with the Moabites. If you have those Bibles open, you can turn back with me to Deuteronomy chapter 2, because that's really where the story of the Moabites begins for us. And in Deuteronomy chapter 2, verse 9, he talks to them about the people of Moab, and he says this: "The Lord said to me, 'Do not harass Moab or engage them in battle, for I will not give you any of its land as a possession, since I have given Ar as a possession to the descendants of Lot.'" Moab is one of the children of Lot. Lot was the nephew of Abraham. Abraham's the father of Israel. So Moab and Israel and Moab's brother Ammon, they're all related. So these are relations. Moab is not one of the nations that God was sending the Israelites into Canaan to judge for their sinfulness over the last 1,000 years. They're not one of those. They're not one of the judged ones. In fact, when God sends Israel into the promised land, he demarcates areas for each of the tribes and for each of the families in Israel, and he lays out space for Moab and for Ammon. But Moab had been discontent with their tribal territory. They weren't happy with the land that God had marked off for them. And so, when Israel was in periods of weakness, like they are here, because they lived in sin and God took his hands of protection away, and so now Israel was vulnerable, the Moabite people took advantage of that and used it as an opportunity to extend their borders. And so they created a little allied group between them, their cousins, the Ammonites, and enemy group, the Amalekites, and they used the opportunity to come in and to invade Israel and put the Israelites under subjection to their rule. Moab wanted more. And so during seasons where God is not protecting Israel, more was easy to get. But in the story of Ehud that we've just read together, their discontent, which gave them 18 years of extending their territory, turns out greatly to their disadvantage, because when God finally raises up Ehud, he kills their king, and the people of Moab go into chaos for 80 years. Now let's talk about boundary stones. But there are three passages that are important here to understand why it was such a problem for Moab to do what they did. Deuteronomy chapter 19, verse 14. This is what Moses tells the people on God's behalf. "You must not move your neighbor's boundary marker set up by former generations on the property that will be allotted to you in the land that the Lord your God is giving you to possess." You must not move your neighbor's boundary marker. We're talking about the lines that divide families from each other, the fence line, the property line. We're talking about the lines of the tribes, which would be like the lines of our states. We're talking about national lines. "You must not move your neighbor's boundary marker set up by former generations." Proverbs 22:28 picks up on the same theme and says, "Do not remove the ancient landmark that your ancestors set up." Proverbs chapter 23, verse 10, again, "Do not remove an ancient landmark or encroach on the fields of orphans, for their Redeemer is strong. He will plead their cause against you." It was a great temptation in the history of Israel that when the property next door went up for sale and the people went on hard times, they wanted it. And God requires them not to buy it. In fact, every 70th year in the year of Jubilee, or 50th year in the year of Jubilee, they had to give back any property they had bought that wasn't originally allotted to them by God. It had to all be returned to original owners every 50 years. And the Moabites didn't listen. We have to remember that this was Israel, and that the properties we're talking about here in the land of the judges were deliberately divvied up by God, by His will, to move those boundaries in that context would be to be discontent with what God had given, to want more than God had allotted. And that is essentially what caused Moab to move into Israel's territory during the time of God's judgment. And it's that encroachment that eventually leads to the downfall of Moab. The Israelites were not allowed to attack Moab, and they never would have had Moab not been discontent and moved into their territory. Now, that might seem like academic, and it might seem ancient, and it might seem like geopolitics, and what do we care about that? But I really do think there's application today, specifically in terms of our own personal contentment with the land that God has demarcated for us to live in. You and I personally, our families. Here's a quotation from Tim Suttle that I think in this idea of not moving boundary stones, you might find increased meaning. Tim writes this: "I'm writing from a different assumption than most of the leadership books I've read. The typical assumption of most books on church and ministry, even those written more recently in the missional church field, is the idea that the church's job is to grow. A healthy church is a church that grows bigger. My argument is that this assumption is built not on the gospel, but on the American narrative. When we read the New Testament through the lenses of colonialism and consumer capitalism, we can't help but accentuate those bits of scripture that portray expansion and growth. This means that it's easy for us to concentrate on the Great Commission and consider this to be the pinnacle of all of Jesus' vision for the church. Interestingly, the most stringent and forceful teaching, the Sermon on the Mount, for instance, can be all but lost in a leadership culture that's committed to growth without limits. This is a false assumption. The church's job is not to grow. The church's job is not to thrive. The church's job is not even to survive. The church's job is to be faithful." Moab, I'm sure, had their reasons for taking advantage of Israel's weakness and conquering or annexing some of their territory. We've all had our reasons, and at the time, and maybe even in hindsight, it probably seems reasonable to us. What could be wrong with more? But though some expansion is certainly legitimate, there are times in Israel's history where they were commanded to expand. The conquest of Canaan being an example of that. Some may be legitimate, but the history of Israel and of the church insists that all expansion is not legitimate. Getting bigger is not always better. Having more is not always ideal. Discontentment is a terrible motivation for Christians. Moab should have stayed within their borders no matter what God was doing to Israel, but they wanted more. So now let's talk about the discontented heart. And we're back here in 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 6. I'm going to read it again. "Of course, there is great gain in godliness combined with contentment. For we brought nothing into the world so that we can take nothing out of it. But if we have food and clothing, we will be content with these. But those who want to be rich," read this how it means to be read, not just people with lots of liquid cash, "those who want to have a lot of stuff, materially, personally, gift-wise, intellectually, property, influence, fall into temptation and are trapped by many senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. For the love of money, the love of wealth, the love of security, the love of influence, the love of power is a root of all kinds of evil. And in their eagerness to have these things, some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pains." Sometimes this passage fails to speak powerfully to us because we assume that Paul's point was simply to do some self-care and self-introspection and decide whether I really love what I have or I just like it. And we think that's the point. And so if I can settle in myself that I don't love it, I don't have to read that passage. But Paul's point is slightly less generous. Discontentment with what we have or with who we are lies at the root of much of the conflict we face in our lives. Discontentment with what we have or with who we are lies at the root of much of our conflict, our anger, our resentment, and even our self-esteem. How would our lives change if we stopped chasing more or better and we lived lives of contentment? Contentment with what we have physically and biologically. Contentment with the family that we have, the spouse that we are in covenant relationship with, the children that have been entrusted to our care. Contentment with our home, with our car, with the gifts and graces that we have. What would our lives look like? That doesn't mean we should live lazy lives. You've got to, what I'm trying to help you do is reimagine something that I know you've been raised to think is impossible, and so have I. But the scriptures force us to consider it, that there are other motivations for being hard and dutiful workers, productive, inventive, experimental people that are not discontentment. We can be motivated to work hard, to be productive, to be faithful, to share the gospel by something other than territory expansion. The New Testament insists both that we are to be hard and productive and dutiful workers, and still at the same time be content with what we have. We can be hard workers, productive workers, risk takers, involved in the world, and still be content with what we have. And yet there's been no shortage of Christian writers throughout our history who have tried to sanctify the spirit of discontentment in our hearts and in the church. The falling of the Moabites to the hand of Ehud is only one of dozens of narratives in the Christian Bible that reveal the eventual peril of the motto, more, more, more. Matter of fact, you can see that that very attitude was so in the heart of Moab that it was in the heart of the king Eglon. And Ehud was able to play on it. It's how he was able to kill him, because what did he offer him? I've got money for you! And of course, this is the king of the nation of Moab. They've taken over Israel. You'd think he'd have enough, but it's never enough. So all Ehud had to do was say, you want a little more? And he says, absolutely. This is an enemy. He had conquered this guy. By what stretch of the imagination should he have been alone in a room with him? But hey, it's more stuff! So he did it. And he took Ehud into his inner chambers. And then Ehud said, not only do I have more stuff for you, which you were happy to receive, but I have a word from God for you. And of course, Eglon thinks, well, how much more power could I have than that God wants to speak to me? Lay it on me, son! And he laid it on him, a sword in the belly. He preyed on that discontent, on that hunger for more, on the lust for power, and Ehud was able to use it to bring Eglon down. Are you as vulnerable as he was? And so the question we must always ask of our discontentment is, has God placed boundary stones for me here? Is this the territory allotted? Like it or hate it? Whether it's great farmland or terrible desert, whether it's suffering or blessings, whether it's wealth or poverty, we still have to ask the question, has God placed boundary stones here for me? It won't always be yes. But it will sometimes be yes. Simply because I want more does not mean I should have it. The more like Jesus we become, the less we will need our motivation to be hardworking or productive or even good people to come from discontent. We can be hardworking and productive and inventive and creative and experimental and risk-taking from another motivation. The motivation of adventure with the God of all creation. The motivation to be faithful because it is an end in itself. The motivation to share the gospel not so people like me or so we can get bigger, but the motivation to share the gospel because these people need it and we love people. There are other motivations, but for some reason it's hard for us to see past discontentment. The scriptures tell us there is great gain in godliness combined with contentment. This is the essence of Sabbath. And I am convinced that we are losing this in our time, partially because we sacrificed the Sabbath. Do you remember what God did on the Sabbath? He looked back over what he had done and he was content. He said, "It's very good." He took time to reflect on the work of his hands and he was okay with it. That's Sabbath. Do you give yourself one day out of the week where the tasks do not rule your life, where the have-tos are not piling up, and instead you sit down and say, "Today I am content with the work I have done. I need do no more. I'm fine." Contentment is the essence of Sabbath. And contentment is at the heart of peace. If all we want is more, 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 we'll never be at peace. We'll be hungry. That's an appetite. We have to find peace, and it's found in contentment. Contentment helps us to be who we are called to be no matter what. Sabbath is one of the biggest ways God gives us to build contentment into our lives, to reflect on what he has given, what he has done, what we've accomplished, and to let the rest go for one day. I know it feels like the world will fall apart. Sometimes life exposes in us where our motivation is coming from. And it has to come from a place of peace, from a place of Sabbath, from a place of trust. And sometimes we just have to recognize that God has demarcated a territory for us to live in. And we may not like all of it, but it is what he has entrusted to us. And we might want to pray for more or better or different, but we have to show that we can be faithful with what he has entrusted before he'll ever entrust more. And it's up to him if he ever does. But it's those who are faithful with little that God gives more. It is not to those who are discontent with little that God gives more.